I told you it was going to be a good show this afternoon, didn't I? Freddie Mercury and Queen, It's a Kind of Magic. Freddie Mercury was one of rock's most dazzling frontmen when he died in 1991, 25 years ago, can you believe it? The music world lost one of its most flamboyant characters, as well as a supremely talented writer and vocalist. Best known as the lead singer with Queen, of course, his amazing four-octave voice was a distinctive element in the band's unique sound, which resulted in more than a dozen million selling albums. Mark Blake's Freddie Mercury, A Kind of Magic, charts his extraordinary career in the context of the life he led in the glare of rock stardom. With expert understanding, Mark traces Freddie's astonishing achievements from his childhood in Zanzibar and India to his world-conquering performance at Live Aid in 85 and beyond. Published, as I said, just around the time of Freddie's 70th birthday, this special book features a retrospective commentary on his studio and live albums, a complete discography, photographs and memorabilia throughout. It's exhaustive, about a great man who is exhausting live, the great Freddie Mercury. Delighted to join on the line from the UK, Mark Blake. Mark, good afternoon.
Good afternoon, hello.
It's amazing, isn't it? Freddie at 70, can you imagine what he would have been like?
Yeah, I thought about it a lot, actually, while I was doing this, and I think that's one of the things you do end up wondering, don't you? Because he died so young. You do wonder what he would be doing now.
Yeah, and it's one of these things, I suppose, as we all get older, you sort of think that, you know, Freddie passed maybe 10 years ago, and of course then you suddenly realise it's 25 years ago. I'm amazed that there hasn't been, you know, a definitive book like yours out before, because, you know, he really was not only a great showman, which, after seeing Live Aid and all those performances, which we'll come on to in a bit, but... you know, he was also a consummate musician and a great singer-songwriter. I mean, you think of the work that he did with Queen, and it was pretty much, you know, he was the starting point for some of the great rock anthems of the 70s and 80s.
Yes, absolutely. I think that's the thing. I mean, you know, you rarely hear a conversation about Freddie Mercury now. It doesn't use the word flamboyant and so on. And the showmanship is definitely a huge part of it, and we should never shy away from that. They were a fantastic live band. He was very funny and a great frontman. But I think one of the things I did want to tackle a bit on this book is that you forget just how good a songwriter he was. I mean, it must be a nightmare if you hate Queen, because you just can't escape the music, even now. And I don't know how it is there, but in the UK, you know, you cannot turn on the TV without hearing an advert that hasn't got a Queen song.
There's a new advert out for a certain four-wheel drive car, and it's called Another One Bites, Another One Drives a Duster.
That's right, yes, I know that one.
But
yes,
exactly.
We've got that here.
When it's in Spain,
yeah.
Too, and I think you just think, yeah, okay, that
yeah.
one.
So, yeah.
I mean, he was unusual. He looked unusual as well. He didn't look like, you know...
And
he was exotic and flamboyant, and I know we use that word again,
yeah.
But, you know, Zanzibar. Now, just tell us a little bit of where that came from and where he came from.
Well, that's it. I mean, he was born in Zanzibar, you know, the African island, and he was educated in India, in not far from Bombay, or Mumbai, as it's now called. And, you know, a typical kind of boarding school education. So, you know, his parents lived in Zanzibar and sent him away to India to be educated. And, I mean, this is something I'll touch on in the book. I think that gave him a real independence as a person, you know, and a steeliness of character, which I think proved invaluable when he when they later started Queen. He was not a man who gave up easily with anything, and I think that sort of paid off. But yeah, a very exotic, a different upbringing. And then, you know, came back to Zanzibar. There was an uprising, I think, around 1964, a bit of a revolution. And his father was a civil servant and fled the country, literally just taking, you know, his family with him. And they landed in West London, you know, and ended up living in a house not that far from Heathrow Airport. You know, it really was like that, as immigrants, you know, in a strange new country. And, of course, this is at the point that the Beatles are the biggest thing in the world. And Freddie wanted to be in the Beatles, or wanted to be a pop star from a pretty young age, you know, started calling himself Freddie Mercury, or Freddie, certainly. The Mercury bit came later. And sort of reinvented himself. He reinvented himself when he arrived in the UK.
But, I mean, how did he go about it? I mean, when did he start sort of learning music? Because he was a great pianist as well. I mean, when did he start learning music and putting, you know, things together to become, you know, the artist that we would know?
Well, this is the thing. This is the interesting thing about him. Because he died so young and he was so secretive about his past, it's always been a bit of a challenge to a biographer. And some of the people I managed to track down were his first friends in the UK. And, you know, they remember him as a 16, 17-year-old playing songs on the piano, playing Beatles songs, Beach Boys songs, and sort of reinterpreting them, putting a bit of a spin on them. They can remember him doing that in the common room at their sort of a polytechnic in West London while he was supposed to be studying for a sort of foundation course course in art, so he could get into the art school. But they remember that. And then when he was at Ealing Art School, where he seemed to spend a lot of time listening to Jimi Hendrix rather than actually doing much art, he was, again, messing constantly in the sort of common room, messing about on the piano. And, I mean, even parts of what became Bohemian Rhapsody, we think he had some of that written as far back as sort of 1966, 67.
But it's interesting because you talk about Freddie listening to people like Hendrix and being part of that, you know, that West London art school scene, which spawned, the Stones, Eric Clapton, et cetera, et cetera. But you can't really see Freddie as a hippie, but you can absolutely see Freddie as the glam rock performer, which he became with Queen.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, that was a big part of the image that they wanted to project at the time. I mean, I always say this, Queen were very much a band of the 70s. They weren't a band of the 1960s. I mean, Brian May and Roger Taylor had a little group together before called Smile, who was sort of a bit like Cream. That was the kind of thing they were going for, that late 60s sort of bluesy power rock trio. And Freddie Mercury was very, very much about putting on a show, whereas a lot of bands at the time would stand there, hair over the face, playing a 20-minute guitar solo. He was all about, no, you've got to project. You've got to be showbiz. And at the time, there was some criticism, I think, from people who saw them very early on, that, you know, it wasn't very cool. It wasn't cool to be like that, you know? And he was the person who turned around and said, no, he brought a lot of theatricality to it. So you're right, the glam style was definitely the first style he embraced as a performer.
And also, if you look at, some of the albums that came out, Day at the Races, A Night at the Opera, with the coat of arms, if you like, the Queen, the symbols and stuff like that. I mean, very much of its time. When did the breakthrough then come with Freddie? And how did the Queen get together from Smile? Was it a case of Freddie saying, right, I want you on guitar and you, Taylor, when you put the girls down, I want you drumming?
Yeah, well, I mean, I don't think Roger ever put the girls down, did he? You know, but Freddie joined Smile, really, and then forced them to change their name to Queen. He was their, well, I say he was their roadie. By all accounts, he'd managed to carry a tambourine up a flight of stairs. He didn't go much. Apparently, he was the worst roadie of all time. But he was their friend, and he was constantly nagging them. Specifically, I think, Brian May, saying, you should do this, you should wear these clothes, why don't you try this, why don't you try that? And when you speak to their friends at the time, they say it was glaringly obvious that he wanted to be in the band, but it wasn't until their sort of singer and bass player left that he sort of snuck in, and they then hired another bass player, which eventually was John Deacon, and they changed the name to Queen. But, you know, I think they'd been at the point where Smile hadn't had any breakthrough. I mean, they played gigs supporting Pink Floyd and Hendrix, I think, and it hadn't got anywhere. So it's like, well, let's let Freddie have his say, you know, let's try it his way. And obviously it worked, but it did take time. It took a long, long time, you know, and probably a bit longer than people remember now. And I think by the time they got a record deal and started making records, they were incredibly ambitious, all of them, especially Freddie Mercury. They didn't want to hang around. They wanted hits.
Were they a hard-working band? I mean, did they do a lot of touring? Did they do a lot of gigging?
No, they didn't do as much touring because they signed this sort of deal with a production company, which is all very complicated and cost them a lot of heartache and money later on. But they took them off the road to concentrate on writing songs, and I think that paid off very well in hindsight. But they certainly did a lot of up and down, schlepping up and down the motorway in the back of a van. There was plenty of that going on, but they didn't tour quite as relentlessly as other groups. So when they suddenly were unleashed on the world as Queen, a lot of people didn't actually know where they'd come from. You know, which I think possibly went against them. But they had done their time, definitely.
And also the other thing is, of course, all that time in the studio, you cannot... I mean, I was flicking through some Queen back albums the other day, the back catalogue, of which, you know, I have quite a few lurking out there. But, you know, the production... on the, you know, I mean, you think Bohemian Rhapsody, obviously, because of what happens in Bohemian Rhapsody, and the fact it was perhaps, if you like, one of the first ever music videos like that. But, you know, the production values on the stuff that, you know, Queen put out, News of the World, all that sort of, is pretty damn good even today.
Yes, it is. And, I mean, again, this was a part of this sort of, they were incredibly painstaking. I mean, you know, Brian May, in another life, would have been a scientist, you know. He would have probably been discovering a new planet or something like that. And I think he brought that. They all did, but Freddie Mercury as well. Painstaking attention to detail, you know. And it paid off, like you say. But his influences came from so many different places, you know. They were never just a conventional rock band. I mean, they sort of sounded a bit like Led Zeppelin, didn't they, at the beginning? But then it sort of... goes off somewhere completely different.
Well, I think isn't there a great thing that Brian May, who said he was famously, you know, Freddie was playing him Bohemian Rhapsody for the first time, and it was the piano piece, a piano bit, you know, Mama Just Killed Again. And then he went, and now comes the opera bit, and they just looked around and went, yeah. What?
Yes, yeah. I mean, I don't think anybody had quite understood what it was going to be until they actually got in the process of recording it. And of course, a lot of the recording techniques at the time, I mean, this is primitive compared to now. The stuff you would do on a, you know, stuff you could do in Pro Tools or one of these programs that I've got on my laptop upstairs.
Yeah.
You know, you could do some of this stuff, you know, so quickly compared to how they did it before. It's all analog and spools of tape running all the way around the studio. But of course, you've got to have the idea to do it. So, you know, that's where the creativity comes from.
And one of the great things about Queen, though, if you think about it, it was, you know, sometimes with bands, they're all pretty same-ish, the people. But if you look at the way that Queen were made up, you've got, you know, Roger Taylor, who is a drummer full, and like you said, you know, he's all the hair and the girls and the whole bits and pieces and the cars. You've got, you know, you've got John Deacon, who is very much, if you like, the invisible man of Queen, just plodding away with the bass lines. Brian May fiddling superbly up and down, arpeggios up and down the keyboard. And then you've got Freddie. So it really was a fantastic mixture of parts all coming together at the same time.
Yes, it was. I mean, and probably four parts that wouldn't work, you know, under any other circumstances. Yeah, there's a very strange chemistry within the group. But by all accounts, you know, the arguments are legendary. I mean, they argue like nobody's business. But by all accounts, you know, Freddie was sort of the arbitrator in the studio. You know, he's actually quite good at sort of calming the other ones down. So it is a very peculiar mix of people, yes.
And the other thing is the fact that, you know, they had a fanatically loyal fan base. I mean,
yes.
Queen fans, even now.
Yes, oh God, yes.
How did that all come about? Because, you know, is it just Freddie's connection? Because he had this gift of connecting with an audience live?
I don't know. I think it's partly to do with that. I think because they were a bit different and unusual, I think they sort of inspired, perhaps they attracted a certain kind of audience. I don't know. I remember their PR, a gentleman called Tony Brainsby, who's no longer with us now. He used to look after the Stones and all sorts of bands in the 60s and 70s. I remember Tony Brainsby, the PR, telling me, he said that when he first started looking after Queen, he went to some of the gigs and he saw older people there, as in pensioners, which of course you never ever saw at a pop concert in 1974. And he presumed a couple of them were parents of the band and found out they weren't. But there was a little old lady who used to ring up the office regularly and ask whenever Queen were playing. He said he noticed then that they started to attract an audience you'd never see at a Mark Bolan gig or a Led Zeppelin gig or something like that. I still can't quite put my finger on what it is. They inspire a degree of fanaticism and loyalty, which I don't think I've quite encountered with any other group.
And also the they've probably recorded one of the best live albums ever, Queen Live Killers, which was...
Yeah, they hate it, though, of course.
Yes.
Yeah.
But it, you know, I mean, part of the fact they left the stage during Bohemian Rhapsody and let the lights take over. But it, I mean, as a live piece of music or an album, it's absolutely superb.
Yeah, it's really rough and loud. And I mean, it's constantly astonishing. It was only four of them that made that racket at the time. I mean, later on in the 80s, they had a sort of a keyboard player tucked to the side. He used to do a bit of rhythm guitar. But not on Live Killers. I mean, it really is just the four of them.
They could have gone down that hairy old rock way, if you like, being a bit flamboyant. But, you know, Freddie's had a dalliance, because obviously, you know, Freddie's sexuality was also an important part of what made him. And, you know, as the 80s came in and it got, music became a bit more poppy, they were well sort of poised to do different stuff. So I'm thinking about doing the soundtrack for Flash and the stuff with Bowie and Under Pressure, of course, which was just at the end of the 70s. But they were able to sort of really tap into the mainstream at the early 80s as well.
That's right, yeah. I mean, it was a big change, a really big turnaround. But, I mean, you know, Freddie Mercury had always been into... I mean, you know, in the 60s when everybody else was sitting around sort of stoned and listening to The Who's Tommy, he was raving about Michael Jackson at the time and the Jackson 5. And everybody, and the other sort of hippies in the house were telling him to shut up and, you know, carry on listening to Led Zepp or something. You know, so he always had that pop sensibility all the way through. And, he's into Liza Minnelli, you know, as much as he was, you know, the Beatles or something, or the Stones or something like that. So there are all these other influences. And you're right, I think they seem to make quite a concerted decision not to get left behind at the end of the 70s. But I do think it was a natural progression. I don't think they forced themselves to go away and have haircuts and start writing on synthesizers. I think that was just a natural way as musicians. They were always very inquisitive. Cliff, especially Freddie, always wanting to do something different. And like you say, they suddenly reinvented themselves as a great pop group in the early 80s.
And also, Freddie, was it the early 80s he started to bring out his own stuff as well? Because he did a couple of solo albums.
He signed an absolutely monstrously huge solo record deal, which turned out to be one of the great follies for the record company. He never made the money back because he was never that successful as a solo artist. It caused a lot of ructions in the band because I think he got more money as an advance as a solo artist than the band had got for whatever their last album was. But in actual fact, as soon as he got out in the studio on his own and was working on his own, you know, he was phoning up Roger Taylor and asking him to sort of fly out to Montreux where they were recording and do backing vocals. I think he missed being a part of a group, you know, and I've always thought that he did all his best work with Queen. You know, I think, you know, he tried as a solo act. He had a couple of modest hits here, but he never took off. He never took off the way that Queen did.
1985.
Yes.
The small matter of Live Aid. Now, it had been, you know, we'd had the signal do the Christmas. You know, the Wembley gig had been announced. If ever there was, and there were several, you know, there was big names playing at Wembley. Obviously, Bowie was there. McCartney was going to be there. The rock royalty was there. If ever there was an occasion for Queen to stamp their mark on something, then this was it. And you know, it's got to be, what was it, 15 minutes, 20 minutes of absolute brilliance.
Yeah, I think it's something like 17 minutes. And I think the reason it worked more than anything else is, unlike a lot of groups there, I remember watching this in a pub about 3 or 4 miles from Wembley Stadium. And you could see how other groups came along and it's like, yeah, this is fine. And then they came on and they did the hits, but they'd done it as a medley of hits. So you had a bit of Bohemian Rhapsody leading into Radio Gaga. So in their 17-minute slot, or however long it was, they had rehearsed this to the nth degree. They'd actually timed themselves. They had clocks in front of the rehearsal stage, so they knew exactly how long they had, and they worked out the set of exactly what they were going to play. And they just came in, like you say, they kind of knocked it out of the park. And a huge smile on their face, a huge smile on Freddie Mercury's face. He was completely playing to the gallery, having a lot of fun with it, showing off, not taking himself too seriously, which I think was always a great bonus of his performances at that particular time. And like you say, they won everybody over.
I mean, the thing is as well, I mean, were they nervous before going on? I mean, had they been backstage? Because other people were having a riotous time, by all accounts, backstage at Live Aid.
Oh, I believe they were, and I'm pretty sure they would have had a riotous time themselves afterwards. But I think, I don't know if they were specifically nervous. The problem is, at the time, they were going to take time off. They were sick to death of each other, by all accounts. And, you know, there was even some question mark over whether they would have carried on. Mm. They were certainly looking to take a break at that point. And I think they suddenly realised just how well they were going down. And the boost to the back catalogue and the boost to their profile afterwards was incredible. You know, even back then, before we had the internet and everything else. And I think that gave them, I think that Live Aid, well, it did, it gave them a second wind, if you like.
Well, I mean, I remember reading, because this is before the internet, you know, I had the NME that week, and even they were singing Queen's praises. And for a, you know, a magazine or a newspaper who were as sniffy as the NME were, to say, you know, the very brilliant, you know, Freddie Mercury sings whilst Brian May fiddles, and saying how everybody liked Queen, was quite something. Going on, though, I mean, then there was the kind of magic tour, and they just got bigger and better, didn't they, basically, with these big tours?
Yes, that's it. But, I mean, you know, they were back in the studio, having planned to take a year or 2 years off, they were back in the studio, sort of capitalising on Live 8 and did a kind of magic, and then came out and toured the stadiums again. And, you know, this is the point. They were up. They were bigger than ever in the UK then, because they were playing stadiums at that point. They hadn't actually done Wembley Stadium before they did Live 8. They were still in the arenas, remember around that time. And like you say, it became absolutely huge, but towards the end of the kind of magic tour, it's obvious that Freddie Mercury, I think, was aware that perhaps his health wasn't great. Didn't tell the band members anything, and you know, they have said retrospectively that they did wonder if that might be the last tour. Of course, it turned out that's exactly what it turned out to be.
I caught them on that tour. They played a gig in southern Spain, and they were absolutely magnificent, I must admit.
Yeah, I saw them on that tour and the final show at Nebworth.
So, you know, Freddie's health. When did Freddie's health then start? Because he was very. He didn't.
let people know that he was suffering from HIV and made the announcement, and then the next day he was gone, wasn't it? It was the way he did it rather stylish. I mean, there'd been rumours about, you know, his ill health, and then, you know, and then he wasn't with us anymore.
Yeah, well, I mean, he was being pursued by The Sun at the time and other newspapers. You know, no one's entirely sure exactly when he found out, but I think I've heard that he didn't so much find out that he was HIV positive. It was more like, you have AIDS. I think he'd kind of gone past that stage and was already... He became ill very quickly, is my understanding of it, and then literally just sort of retreated to the house. I mean, you know, it was another time, and you realise now that the kind of attitude towards everything, from homosexuality to his illness, is completely different now than how it was in the early 90s. Because I'm so ancient, I still think of the 90s as being not that long ago.
Yeah, but
you know, when you read the newspaper reports and the stuff that was being written in papers even then, you'd think it would be inconceivable now in 2016. You know, and this is the reason that he went to ground as much as he did, because there was such a huge stigma around the illness, a lack of understanding, and also a huge stigma. He didn't want the rest of the band to become stigmatized because of it. And he just thought that, which is why, part of the reasons why he chose to sort of disappear and never, I mean, he never discussed his sexuality in public, and he certainly never discussed his illness.
When it came to writing the book, how willing were people to speak about Freddie, and how did you go about getting the information?
Yeah, no, it was good. I mean, you know, I'd written a lot about Queen before. You know, I'd written a biography of Queen a few years ago, which helped enormously with this. People are willing and are willing to talk about it, and it's always interesting. For me, it was particularly interesting to find the people who knew him before he was famous. You know, and there's photographs in this book, the first photographs of him ever in England, you know, and he looks the least like a pop star in this crowd. But people were willing to talk. You know, I spoke to, you know, the producer of some of these albums. I spoke to Mike Moran, who worked with him on some of his solo material. You know, again, because as much as anything, they're quite keen to get across his abilities as a songwriter, you know, which kind of gets lost a bit sometimes, I think, behind the showmanship. Is it like the guy wrote songs? I mean, I always think he could have been a great radio jingle writer. The songs he wrote, just book it. Yeah. But I do, and I don't say that in any, you know, to denigrate it at all. I just think these songs are so ridiculously catchy. It's like I said earlier, if you hate Queen, you just want to kind of, you'd have to go and turn the TV off or just hide, because you can't, it must be terrible, because you can't get away from them.
When you were going through the researching the book, was that because you got the, you know, memorabilia and going through all the bits and pieces? Were there one bit, or there's one bit that stood out and made you think, "Wow, I haven't come across that before." That's fantastic.
Well, yeah, the photographs of him his first photographs of him in the UK, because, you know, none of that stuff has ever, it's never been printed before. It's just him messing around with his mates at college. One of his mates happened to have a camera with him, and they just took some silly photos. You know, he's about 17 at the time. Those were the things that I thought were fascinating, because he had such, he controlled his image and he controlled the access to his life so much while he was alive. He died young. He spoke to nobody about the past. It's like he invented himself in 1973 or 74, whenever the Queen started making records. He never discussed his childhood or his teenage years or anything. And in fact, one of the guys I tracked down actually said to me, I've been expecting a call like this for 20, 30 years. He said, and I've always been amazed that no one's done it before. And by the way, here are some photos of us, you know, as 17-year-olds. You know.
Fantastic. The book is called Freddie Mercury. Oh, you know, just before I go, I mean, you know, it would have been his 70th birthday last week.
Yeah.
I mean, do you think he would have retired into, you know, if he was still around, he would have retired if he kept his health and, you know, be doing, sort of living the grand damn life somewhere in West London? Or do you think he'd be now putting on musicals or writing radio jingles?
Yeah, I think he would have stayed in music. I mean, he always used to make fun of the Rolling Stones, apparently, for the fact that they were still sort of cranking it out at 40. But, I mean, you know...
He'd be loving it now, then, wouldn't he?
Yeah, but at the end of the day, they all said that, didn't they? And look who's still touring. I personally think that, you know, he was always very scathing about the idea of being an old rocker on stage, but I think I think Queen would have taken a break and then come back together again. In fact, I think it's a source of immense frustration to the other members that, you know, for a long period of time, they couldn't get together and play stadiums when they're watching all these other bands do exactly that. And I think that's precisely why they're out there with Adam Lambert doing it now.
You know? Yes, of course. But it gets to prove as well that the songwriting ability, because, you know, they're doing stuff, you know, they did stuff with Paul Rogers, they did stuff with George Michael, but it's the songs that are carrying them through, it's not the performers, and those songs are basically Freddie's.
Yes, Well, most of them are, yeah. And I think you just need to have someone who can do justice to it. But I think he's still been involved in music, maybe in musicals or something, you know. I mean, obviously you had the We Will Rock You, the West End stage show.
Yes.
I mean, that's not my thing at all. But because I saw the real thing, Queen, but that's a whole audience there who never saw Queen, you know, and who've gone and bought the records and you know who Freddie Mercury is through a West End musical. And, you know, I'm sure he would have embraced that. I think that would have appealed to him a great deal.
Well, those of us who were lucky enough to see them live, like yourself and myself, would know how good he was.
Yes,
The book's called Freddie Mercury, A Kind of Magic. If people want to find out a little bit more about yourself with the book, can they do you social media? Is there Facebook?
I've got a website, and I'm on Facebook and social media, yeah.
And the website, what, is markblake.com?
Markrblake.com.
The book's called Freddie Mercury, A Kind of Magic. It's published now by Backbeat Books, and it's written by Mark Blake. Mark, it has been a pleasure to speak to you this afternoon. Have a great weekend.
Thank you very much.